Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I have a pretty special guest today. I think you guys are really going to get a kick out of this. She lives actually right here by me, and I've known her for years, and I just sort of discovered her book that she's written and was published just last year. And so Jan Kohler-Matznik is an owner currently of Rhodesian Ridgebacks. She is a biologist and an author, and has spent many, many years studying why dogs are not wolves. So, welcome, Jan.
Well, thank you for having me.
Excellent. So this is kind of one of your lines in your book, I didn't want to grow up and be a heretic.
Yeah, who knew that this shy girl could catch on to something and then not be able to let it go and get brave enough to actually publish about it.
Okay, so give me the 411. Give me a little bit of your background. Let's talk to our listeners. What brought you to 2016 and publishing a book that flies in the face of established scientific theory?
I was born a dog person, number one, from the time I could walk. And I was a professional trainer for a long time. And then I went back to college to become a biologist and study animal behavior. And I did this at 36, so by then I'd had a lot of experience with dogs. And one day, walking across the campus, reading yet again the story of the origin of the dog, Juliet Clutton Brock, the lovely English anthrozoologist, who said, and wolves fit easily into human families because they're a pack animal. And I came to a screeching halt and went, oh man, she has never tried to live with a wolf. I have. And they definitely do not fit easily into any human society ever.
No, they do not.
So that's what got me going, because up to that point, this was in like 1993 or so. Up to that point, I just had accepted what all the experts were saying, that the dog was a domesticated gray wolf. And I loved gray wolves, so that was fine with me. But then I suddenly realized, from a human and canid dog wolf behavioral point of view, it just wouldn't work. And so that's what got me started. And for the next 24 years, I just read everything I could, studied all the literature. And the more I learned, the more convinced I became that I was right and everybody else was wrong.
Love that.
But it's because the people who are writing these things, they may know domestic dogs, like they're domestic dog people, like James Serple. Mm-hmm. They may have some very minor secondhand experience with wolves, like Coppinger, but they were never intimately involved with these animals. So
tell us, because you were intimately involved with the New Guinea singing dogs, and really, from what I am understanding from your book, that is what really kind of brought you the next step in the development of your hypothesis.
That's right, because once I had got this idea that it wasn't the gray wolf, I wanted to study the most primitive dog in order to see how wolf-like they are. And originally I was thinking Australian dingoes, but I found you couldn't get them in the United States unless you're an accredited zoo. Mm-hmm. And in a book, the Encyclopedia of Dog Breeds, I found a picture of this New Guinea singing dog. So I tracked down the only man in the U.S. who had him at the time, Dr. Eiler of Brisbane at the University of Georgia, because I wanted, at that point, I wasn't even sure they were dingoes. But believe me, when I got my first two puppies, Boona and Toofy, at 8 weeks old, and I got them home from Portland Airport and set them on the floor, I was just standing there with my mouth hanging open going, I don't know what these are. They don't act like a wolf puppy. They don't act like a dog puppy either. Maybe a fox or a cat, but they're very bizarre.
Interesting.
So 25 years later, and studying these dogs, I realized that it was probable that the ancestor of the dog was not a pack animal, because singers cannot be maintained intact singers. Neutered and spayed ones sometimes, but intact singers can't be kept in groups. only opposite sex pairs because they're so aggressive during breeding season. And this makes sense in their natural environment because they live in the high mountains of New Guinea where there's only small prey that's kind of hard to find and widely scattered. So you can't maintain a pack anyway. And then I started reading on the very small amount of research that's been done on free-ranging dogs, feral dogs.
Right.
And in Italy, mostly in Italy, and in India a little bit. Sunil Pal did some studies in India.
Mm-hmm.
And while they have groups, they don't have hierarchical packs. They kind of all pick a leader and they follow the leader, but they don't, partly because of their ecology, they're scavengers, so they're not having to gang together to hunt down giant prey.
Right. They're not, those dogs that you're talking about, the feral dogs, are domestic dogs who live in the wild but scavenge rather than hunt for food, correct?
Right, right. None of the feral dogs so far studied were hunted, basically. I mean,
right.
Opportunistically, if a rabbit jumped up in
right.
front of them, of course they did it. But they all survive off of human waste. They go to the garbage dump.
Right.
Whereas the dingoes, both in Australia and New Guinea, are fully wild subspecies. They
right.
do not depend on people in any way, and they're top predators. So that's why I always assumed they were the most primitive, the earliest group, because I don't think they were ever fully domesticated. And
right.
that was why I wanted to study the singers, because their behavior would be most like the ancestor, because it hasn't been changed by humans selecting them for any work or purpose or anything.
And by the ancestor here, you're talking about this amorphous dog ancestor that wasn't the gray wolf.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay, so I'm going to use your book here, and we're going to go through each one of these. These are the basic points of your hypothesis, and we'll include, for our listeners, we're going to include a whole bunch of information in the show notes, as well as links to Jan's book that you can actually purchase and read this for yourself. But to sort of break it down and give you some ideas what we're talking about, your first basic operating hypothesis that the dog was never Canis lupus, the gray wolf. It was a naturally evolved species before it attached itself to humans.
Yes. And there's lots of reasons for that. It took me a whole book to
exactly
to explain it.
Exactly.
But mostly it was because I felt that the gray wolf, even the smaller wolves of Asia, are too big.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't, I said, fit into human society because mm-hmm. they're just by nature dangerous,
mm-hmm.
even when they're playing,
mm-hmm.
especially with children. And the people, say, 20,000 years ago, didn't have chains or anything like
right.
that. So they had no way to keep them captive. And I just could imagine this Paleolithic mom with a little toddler who's chewing on an elk bone, teething, and this adolescent wolf running in, knocking the kid down, grabbing the rib, and
running off.
I don't think that Paleolithic mom would put up with this for too long. So I figured, number one, it had to be a smaller critter.
Okay.
And number two, it had to be something that could survive on scraps.
Right.
And wolves definitely can't do that. They would become very malnutritioned. The people, hunter-gatherer people, before there were permanent towns, just didn't produce garbage dumps. So there's no way a wolf, Ray Kovniger's hypothesis, wolves started eating its dump and the more
mm-hmm.
friendly ones
mm-hmm.
got the most food, therefore,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah, blah. Well, no, because there weren't any garbage dumps 20,000
right.
years ago.
Right.
And people pretty much utilized everything they could gather or kill.
Right.
So what was left wasn't enough nutrition to support a wolf, let alone a population. One tamed wolf does not a domestic dog make.
Correct. Right. Lots of years worth of doing this. And so the other thing that I thought was really, really fascinating and telling in the book, you talk about the skull and the jaw shape of the dog versus the wolf, and that mm-hmm. those were adapted differently. So talk about what, I mean, you're talking about the scavenging, but
yeah.
also different types of hunting.
Right. Well, and I actually did a study, which someday I'll get it finished and published, where I measured dogs. I used husky, Malamute husky, German Shepherd mixes and huskies because they have a more natural skull.
Mm-hmm.
And dingoes, Australian and New Guinea dingoes. And I compared their jaw and skull measurements to this old study that was done that wanted to figure out if we found a bone in an archaeological site, if we measure it, can we tell if that canid was a small game predator, large game predator, scavenger? And pretty much they did fall into these categories. So, of course, the wolf and some of the other big canids, like the dogs, are definitely in the large game predator category. Well, when I did the dogs, they had some measurements that were the same as, like, the same thickness of bone or whatever relative to their size as the wolf. So they're definitely in that wolf category. They're not in the fox or the jackal, which are very small game predators, and they have very delicate bones in their head. But nobody has ever explained the differences between the dog and the wolf in biological terms. What they say is, oh, like Carpenter, oh, they ate garbage and therefore they got smaller. Well, you didn't address how did that change their skull shape.
Right.
Why do they have a raised forehead, dogs, other than the ones we've selected
right.
to be straight like a collie? You know, the natural dog, the dingo, has a raised forehead. And inside there is this cavern that's filled with little spongy bones. But what's that for? And dog jaws actually thicker in relative size than the wolves. So they're definitely adapted to taking prey at least as large as themselves, something that would struggle. And their teeth, their holding teeth, the canine teeth on a wolf are very oval and very sharp on the backside for slashing, because that's how they kill very large animals. They tear at them. Whereas the dog's canine teeth are much more round in cross-section. And they're the same length, however. Everybody says dogs have smaller teeth, but they don't in relation to their size. Their teeth are just as big as a wolf. It's just the dog is smaller.
Right.
But in relation to their skull length, their canines are just as long, but they're not as curved, and they're thicker. So that's what are kinds of things have those kinds of teeth. Cats. And cats kill by holding on. So the more I looked at this, the dog didn't fit in any of the four categories that have been established for canids. They had, you know, really different bones. And the only way to explain it biologically is to say, well, they were able to single-handedly kill things as large or even a little bit larger than themselves, like grabbing it by the throat.
Right.
And this idea was solidified many years ago. There was a New Guinea singing dog that was raised at Hampshire College, where Dr. Coppinger used to work. And he spent his whole life in a chain link cement pen being walked on leash by various students. Well, one night, a new student forgot to put latches both in his gate and the gate to the kennel.
Oh, dear.
So the next morning when they arrived, he had let himself out and killed and partly eaten one of their experimental sheep.
Yes.
You know, the most he would have been is 30-pound dog, and the sheep's about 125 pounds.
Right.
And I know sheep aren't real brilliant, but still. So I called up Dr. Feinstein. I want to say Feinstein, but it's not Feinstein. Oh, my, I hate it when the name goes out. I hate getting old. He did vocalization studies at Hampshire College on the singers.
Okay.
And so I called him. And I was all excited as a behaviorist, I'm saying,
right. You
know, how did he kill it? And he goes, oh, this is a really sore subject around here right now. I says, I know, but I really need to know, how did he kill it? Did he slash it like a dog would? And he said, no. He said he killed it with a throat bite.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Which is not how wolves kill their prey.
No. They just bite it wherever they can and until it falls down.
Drag it down. Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So that's what I think. That's why I think the dog skull is different. There people have said, oh, they selected dogs to have this high forehead because it looked cute. Well, I don't think anybody's been selecting dingoes to look cute. And they have. They've been there for at least 20,000 years, and they have high foreheads compared to wolves. So
interesting. Okay, and so you were talking a little bit earlier. We started the conversation. You were talking about some of the behavioral differences between even the New Guinea dogs, so as close to the actual natural state wild dog as one could hope to find, and wolves, in terms of how they live together, how they hunt together, how they reproduce, all of that.
Well, and unfortunately, nobody has ever gone out and actually studied dingo social behavior in the wild. So we have, this is what I'd like to know. They have suppositions in the literature where they'll say, oh, the adults were provisioning the pups because there were lots of bones around this old abandoned den. I'm going, wait a minute. You know, just because the bones were there didn't mean they brought them for the puppy.
Right.
They could have carried back something for themselves. But almost all the studies done on Australian dingoes have been with radio collars, where you can tell proximity if there's two that have radio collars on. But other than that, you can't tell much. So it's very sad. And of course, the New Guinea singing dogs are totally unknown in the wild. We have no idea what's going on there.
Because they're too remote to reach, correct?
Exactly. They live 4,000 feet and above up in the mountains. And it's a really difficult environment, and it's a very difficult culture to work with because the lands are all tribal lands. And so you have to get permissions from each of the tribes that you have to pass through.
Sure.
And a lot of them don't appreciate outsiders coming.
Well, sure.
I don't blame them.
Can't say I blame them.
So what we know of dingo social behavior is just what we've learned in captivity. And in captivity, like I said, we can't keep puppies with their parents for longer than 9 months because they have an annual breeding cycle, and they come in late summer, early fall. And when that happens, the same-sex adult starts harassing their pup. So the female starts harassing the female puppies, and the male starts harassing the male puppies, to the point that just for the sake of the pup's sanity, we have to remove them.
Okay.
And once you've done that, you can't put them back together.
Right.
So that's why we're thinking in the wild, they have more like coyote behavior or a jackal, where it's a mated pair that keeps the territory.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have to push the young ones out the next breeding season so that they can have enough food for their new litter.
Right, which is very different than the gray wolf, which live in a relatively large family unit, you know, 6, 8, 10 animals,
right,
correct?
Right. And the alphas are the parents. And then the offspring usually stay in a wolf pack 2 to 3 years, and then they'll move on and try to find their own territory. So, and they're what we call obligate pack members because, at least in North America and Europe and parts of Asia like Russia, they prey almost exclusively on very large game, several times their body size. And so it takes more than one. It takes a village in a wolf world.
Yes.
Whereas these other smaller canids, if there's a lot of prey in a certain area, like the dingoes in Australia, when there's outbreaks of rabbits, you get a lot of dingoes coming and hanging out. And it looks like it's giant groups, but they go off and forage on their own.
Okay.
And so I hope I live long enough to actually see somebody go out and spend a year observing a family of dingoes to see what actually happens with them.
Right. Fascinating stuff. Okay. And now the other thing that I think we need to talk about on this concept of the biology, right? So there's behavior and there's biology that are different between the dogs and the wolves. And there's been, with the sequencing of the dog genome and a lot of other very current research, there's an awful lot of similarity between the wolf DNA and the dog DNA. And you do, I think, a pretty good job talking about that in the book. Can you give us sort of the synopsis on that?
Sure. Similarity does not mean ancestor-descendant relationship. So two species can have extremely similar DNA because they came from a common ancestor. And I know that a lot of people think that the species, it's only a species if it can't crossbreed with another species, can't hybridize. But this isn't true. And there's a lot of hybridization in the wild, much more now that they're doing DNA. There's much more than the biologists ever thought about. So most closely related species of anything, birds, fish, mammals in the wild, if they meet, will sometimes make a mistake picking a mate. And so the DNA crosses the species line. And with dogs, I mean, it's obvious the dog is a wolf in clothes. It's not a jackal or a coyote or a fox. It doesn't have, it has the big, heavy skull and the heavy teeth. It's definitely a wolf. And also they've had some hybridization they can find in the DNA of dogs that shows, for instance, the Norwegian Elkhound has some markers that are only in Scandinavian wolves. So at some point in the past, but you can't tell how long ago, some wolves and some dogs in some places bred together and the offspring survived. But that doesn't mean that they're the same species. Actually, if they were the same species, dogs and wolves have been living in the same areas forever, ever since there were dogs. There's been wolves around. And wherever humans have taken dogs, where there's wolves, even in the Arctic. The fact that there's so little hybridization speaks loudly to me that they are two good separate species. Because otherwise, wherever they were, they would blend together.
Right. So the idea being in your mind that there is one common progenitor to both the gray wolf and the dog, and that those separated somewhere along the evolutionary line.
Exactly.
Okay. And you talk a little bit, I thought it was kind of interesting, and has some implications, I think, perhaps for purebred dogs and some of the cries of people ruining dogs by making them purebred and whatever, talking about the bias in research that believes that the dog is not a natural species and that it is an artificial subspecies that is credited by, credited to human activity.
Right.
So can we talk about that a little bit? I mean, what implications does that have for our society other than there's some training pieces I want to talk about, but what additional complications, I guess, does that introduce into our way of thinking about our dogs?
Well,
and purebred dogs in particular.
Yeah. Well, of course, purebred dogs are artificial constructs. And if you threw out a husky in a lab and a golden and a few other things out into the wild and let them eat garbage off the street, voila, you've got something that looks like a dingo. It's
right.
called the Carolina dog. And the same thing happens in other countries, too.
Mm-hmm.
So you take the genes and you put them into an environment where they have to survive in the original lifestyle called a niche that the original dog had, which was scavenger around humans. And you put them back in that environment and slowly, the DNA sorts itself out, and they end up with upright ears instead of drop ears, because drop ears are less viable in the wild because they get more ear infections.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a tail with a curve in it, which nobody but me has ever explained biologically. But I think that the curved tail is from the ancestor. No other canid has a curved tail, just like a question mark. And I think that was because it was really good at signaling, and it probably had a white tip on it, like the dingoes and the same, and most Aboriginal dogs, to send a clear signal, because they weren't a pack animal. So when they met, they had to be able to really signal each other, like, yes, I'm friendly. See, my tail is bobbing around up here. It's not stiff, and that kind of thing. So, but with
which
the
I thought was a fascinating piece of the biological differences is the tail conversation, that wolves have straight tails and all natural dogs and all other canids have a curved tail.
Yeah, right. All dogs have curved tails when they have them, unless they've been artificially selected to not be curved or curled, right? You can get the curve into a curl if you really work at it. But I lost my train of thought, and it was about the purebred dog conundrum. Well, of course, at one point, if you go back far enough, they were all village dogs, Aboriginal village dogs, and then they got specialized for different work, which is great, but the actual purebred part is a biologist, these closed gene pools where they're, when they were selected for work only, like the Border Collie registry in England, any dog that can win a sheepdog trial in Scotland can be added to the sheepdog registry. And that's a good thing. When the breeds that we have, most of them were selected for some purpose, whether it was to be a companion, to be a cute thing sitting on a pillow, or to hunt big game. I think that once you get them away from their purpose, where they're also being selected for their mental abilities and their physical abilities, and you just go on appearance, the gene pool kind of becomes difficult to manage because mm-hmm. you cannot escape. If you're never adding any new animals, you cannot escape continuing increase of inbreeding, which means more health problems. It's like the singers are highly inbred. The captive singers are, they're closer than litter mates, all of them, because we only ever had four founders of the North American population, and that was 50 years ago. So the amazing thing is they routinely live to be 16, 17 years old. They don't get arthritis. They don't have a hip dysplasia. They don't have PRA, you know?
Well, that would seem to argue against inbreeding causing health problems.
Exactly. Except if you're, these were only taken out of nature 50 years ago.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Not 10,000. So it makes a difference. And I think that the singers are going to start to see problems if we can't get any more out of the wild to boost the population, right? I mean, eventually you're going to hit an endpoint. But
well, and I think it's one of the things that's absolutely fabulous that the Basenji Club has done, that they have been able to go to Africa and bring in new dogs that are purebred Basenjis that are literally working with the tribes in an absolutely naturally developed situation.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most amazing things in the American Kennel Club is the work that the Basenji Club has done to bring these dogs in.
Right. And I think a couple of other experiments where the outcross, the low uric acid Dalmatian, are going to be allowed back in the AKC. They're in the United Kennel Club, and I think they're going to, the AKC is finally going to approve them, which is intelligent because after all these generations of being bred back to pure Dalmatians, their genetics, other than the gene, the bad gene they were trying to get rid of, are Dalmatian, and they're beautiful. So I have mixed feelings about the purebred fancy, they call it, that just goes on beauty, but there I am at the show with my Rhodesian Ridgeback.
I was going to say, I see you every weekend, Jan. I don't know, man. Well, and I think, too, one of the things that it speaks to, for me anyway, is the importance of maintaining the function, whatever that function was, of your breed. That that is... that when you include that piece in a breeding program, so German wire-haired pointers, okay, these are my breed. Field work, conformation, health, and temperament, there are very, very few breeders in our country who are not paying attention to all four of those elements at some level.
Well, it's nice that you still have, that your breed still has a job to do, but the truth is that so many breeds,
Ridgebacks
their jobs
don't.
Are gone.
Right. But I think it is one of the things that's interesting, some of the new performance events that are coming in that allow dogs to test trainability, test bitability, test things that are fun for the dog and for the person.
And so, all of which no Aboriginal dog or dingo would ever do. Although, hey, we've had three canine good citizen singers that passed the test.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I know. And one who's made his tracking dog excellent and is working on his master's through the ASCA.
I would
Shepherd
think
Club
that
of
scent work and stuff like that would be things that they would do.
Well, but you see, the problem is you can't take them off leash. And
yeah, but scent work, you don't have to. That's the beautiful part. I've just been learning about it.
Well, that would be definitely something the Aboriginal dogs would be good at because their life depends on it.
Right.
Yeah, I was thinking barn hunts, but my friend said, nope, you have to take them off leash.
No.
And
No. I'm thinking that's a bad idea. Okay, so we got a little sidetracked. I want to go back to one other piece of sort of the behavior differences we're talking about not being pack animals. In your hypothesis in which the dog is a natural species that is not directly descended from the gray wolf, and part of what you're using as your reasoning behind that is the behavioral differences of how the dogs and the wolves interact in a pack environment. And because dogs, in your theory, are not descended from packs, it has implications for all of the things that we do with our dogs. And we're just talking about training. Here's one of those implications. Mm-hmm. How we train those dogs differs based on whether we believe they are pack animals or not.
Exactly. In that dominant theory, where the out in the wolf behavior was always wrong, and David Meach has tried many times to change the world opinion on how a wolf pack is formed and kept together. And it is not formed by force. You can't force a wolf to stay in a pack. So it's an alpha pair, mom and dad, And when mom and dad show up, the pups run up and throw themselves in front of mom and dad because they want to get food. And that's how they get food. And they don't aggressively force other pack members to submit. Now, they get a little fight during breeding season, but it's mostly posturing. And it's like this with the feral dogs, too, and the Aboriginal dogs. The Tsuno Cal studied for 25 years now, 30 years. He studied the same village dog, so many generations.
In India, right?
In India, right. In a village in India. And
it was fascinating.
So he knows them all, and he knows how they're related. And even when a female is in season and may be escorted by five or six males, there's no fighting because the female's going to pick who she wants.
Right.
The males get up there and say, aren't I handsome? Aren't I cute? And, you know, they might posture a little bit at each other. Dingoes, when there's a pack is at a water hole and another pack is approaching, the approaching pack stops some distance away and howls and puts their ears and tail up and postures around until the pack that's already at the water hole leaves. So there's competition and there's lots of posturing and growling and barking, but very little actual physical aggression.
Altercation.
Right. Yeah, which I thought was interesting because we have so much of it in our domestic dogs.
Right, absolutely. Okay, so just in closing, what we talked a little bit off air, what are some of the things that you're looking forward to in the future in terms of there's a lot of unanswered questions in this field and you've just kind of thrown one more monkey wrench into it. So,
well, yeah, I think someday maybe the ancestor of the dog will be found lying in a museum drawer somewhere. Most of the new species described in the last couple of decades have come out of museum drawers because they were misidentified or not identified at all.
Wow.
So hopefully someday somebody's going to pull a drawer open and say, oh my, look at that jawbone. That looks like a dog. And oh, gee, it's 100,000 years old or whatever.
Wow.
And right currently, every paper that comes out has the origin of the dog in Israel, in Europe, in China, in Southeast Asia, just all over the map. And so I don't trust the genetics yet, but there's a group headed by Dr. Gregor Larson. He's in the UK, and he's a paleoanthropologist. He's not a biologist. He's not a geneticist, but he got fascinated. He studied the origin of the pig and the origin of the horse and all these things. And then he got into the dog. And what he's done is he's put together, 3 years ago, an international consortium of biologists, geneticists, paleoanthropologists, paleontologists, all these people that are doing this huge study where they've taken ancient wolves and dogs, Eurasia, and they're sequencing the DNA out of their bones, and they're sampling many more wolves and dogs for the DNA. So hopefully within the next year or so, they'll start to see some results published from this. And I think it'll be fascinating. I don't know that it's going to answer all the questions, but it was 25 years ago, I contacted Peter Saveline and the geneticist who wrote the first dog DNA paper and about the origin of the dog. And I told him, I said, hey, you're not going to find the origin of the dog studying modern breeds. So here's some dingo DNA. Here's some New Guinea Sing dog. Then Adam Boyko, same thing. And he actually sent his brother around the world collecting samples from Aboriginal dogs. So as these collections increase, hoping that we'll get some answers before I die. It's very slow going. I think it's wonderful that there's money for dog studies.
Right.
And the reason, because when I started 20 years ago, there was no money. You know, you couldn't even study dog behavior. So now they have whole departments dedicated to dog behavior and all this DNA work. They did it because they piggybacked on the Human Genome Project. And they said, oh, look, dogs are going to be a great model because they have all these same diseases as people. And that's how they started the dog studies.
Yeah. And it's been very successful. Absolutely. Well, Jan, thank you very, very, very much. I really appreciate your time. This is a fascinating topic. And for any of our listeners who would like to delve into this a little deeper, Dawn of the Dog, The Genesis of a Natural Species. And that's Jan Kohler-Matznik, the author. And we will have a link to that available through Amazon and all your other doggy retailers. And I think everybody ought to just check this out a little bit. It's kind of fascinating stuff. So thank you, Jan.
Thank you very much for having me, Laura.
Appreciate it.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.